You're tuned in to the Jewish Activist Network, broadcasting Wednesday nights from midnight to 1 a.m. I'm Joe Orlo, your host. Again, you're tuned in to the Jewish Activist Network, and our call-in number, please make a note, is 718-569-0921, and you're welcome to participate at any time in our discussion.
So thank you for being with us. We have a special guest with us, Yisrael Danziger from Mishmeret Yesha. Yisrael has been working with Mishmeret Yesha for many years, and he's in right now in the United States and trying to go and talk to people about Mishmeret Yesha. And he's full of information about what's going on in Eretz Yisrael. I think there's a lot for our audience to learn. And so please give it your full attention. Thank you very much for being with us, Yisrael.
You will. Thanks for having me.
Let's first talk about Mishmeret Yesha itself and how it started. And what your main the main categories of your activities are?
Okay, Mishmeret Yesha grew out of a situation that developed in Yesha, which is the acronym for Yehuda, Shomron, and Aza, out of the first Intifada in 1988. When the first Intifada broke out, first was referred to as the first uprising in Judea, Samaria, and Aza. At the time, a situation quickly developed where the Arabs had decided, this actually really happened after what was called the Jibril Exchange, which was at the time 1,450 prisoners were released, the first major prisoner release ever committed by the Israeli government, for the release of six soldiers that were kidnapped in Lebanon. It's referred to as the Jibril Exchange because it was kidnapped by a terrorist organization called headed by Ahmed Jibril, and they negotiated for his release. And not only was it a release of one of the first of any major release of terrorists, including ones that had been involved in serious crimes. But more importantly, the demand of Jibril was to release these terrorists back to their homes, not to be expelled out of the country or to anywhere else or any other Arab country, but actually released back into Israel itself, Israel proper, meaning back to their homes in Hebron, Judea, Samaria, and so on. When that happened, within the period of time of a number of months up to about a year later, these major terrorists that had been held in Israeli prisons for many years managed to organize and coordinate and activate the population throughout Judea, Samaria, and Aza, and activated the first Intifada, which was called Intifada I, first uprising. And they did so believing that by creating a situation, a security crisis, And creating enough difficulty and enough problems throughout throughout Yesha, they would be able to force the Jews to basically run and abandon their homes, abandon their communities, and make life so miserable for them that both the Jews living there themselves would basically give up, and the government of Israel would basically give up as well, saying that it was too difficult to handle the situation, and de facto they would take over Judea, Samaria, and Aza.
What year, Yisrael, was that occurring?
Started in 87, really, but built up in 88, 89. What they planned on doing did not happen. The Jews did not leave. The Jews did not run. But they created a terrible, they made life very miserable for people, especially living in certain places in the outlying communities, especially around the areas of Hebron, Hebron Hill, South Hebron Hill settlements, many other outlying yeshuvim, because what they did was they focused most of their attacks on the people traveling on the roads. They did that by using incredible amounts of rocks, firebombs, roadblocks of every type, and something what they call ninjot, which are basically it's a device that they make up using welding nails together and rolling them onto the roads and causing people to rip up their tires, lose control of their cars. A number of people were killed, by the way, in a lot of these stonings. I myself had a business at the time in Kiryat Arba, and I had a number of people working for me. We had at the time three vehicles that belonged to us, and just about all the work that we did was outside of Kiryat Arba, specifically in the direction of Yerushalayim, and our cars were attacked every day of the week. Imagine getting up in the morning, driving out, and getting stoned on the way to work. I don't know if anybody's listening has ever been stoned driving a car, but if you're driving at 40, 50 miles an hour on a winding road, even in the best of weather, surely in the worst of weather, you can only imagine just the impact of a heavy rock or boulder hitting the car. Whether it smashes the window or not doesn't really matter. If a person is not really aware of what's going on, they can easily lose control. Many people did. Cars were turned over. People were killed. They managed to set up different systems of roadblocks where they would entrap cars and then stone the car, try to stone the person to death while they're in the car, firebomb the car while the person is inside, and so on. And this went on a pretty large basis. What really prodded us to do something was the first organization we set up at the time, which was called Matir Asurim, which was when Jews were basically responding to these attacks to defend themselves, particularly one big case that became the Dehesha trial. It was the name of a big refugee camp, or what they call a refugee camp, in Bethlehem. The bus from Kiryat Arba and the buses from the Hebron communities and settlements in South Hebron Hills used to travel to Jerusalem right through the heart of Bethlehem. All the buses went through there every day. Those buses were attacked. And without getting into too deep into the story, a major attack took place there, and there was a major demonstration that took place at that refugee camp on a Saturday night in response to an attack that took place on a Friday afternoon.
In other words, Erev Shabbos, the Jews were attacked, and Motzei Shabbos, they went there to...
Erev Shabbos, the last bus on the way to Kiryat Arba right before Shabbat.
Mm-hmm.
Those days, the buses didn't have any protective windows, just ordinary glass. And the buses, especially coming on Shabbat, a lot of people come to Hebron for Shabbatot. That bus is packed with people. Aisles are packed and so on. They stoned the bus from all directions. Many people got injured and wounded. The bus pulled in right before Shabbat into Kiryat Arba with a whole bunch of people bloodied up. People went out from Kiryat Arba to demonstrate that for that night afterwards. Rabbi Levinger himself went ahead and set up a hunger strike and an ongoing protest on the main road that passed through Bethlehem for a period of over a month afterwards. But on that Saturday night, a riot took place. They came out from the refugee camp. The Arabs, they started stoning. Shooting took place. Ended up, making a long story short, approximately 35 people from Kiryat Arba were eventually arrested over a major, what really happened before that was the next morning, Amram Mitzna, who became head of the Labor Party later on, he was the general in charge of the Central Command. He, for the first time, used a term that was never used before and said that a pogrom was committed by the Jews against the Arabs. That was a term he used that was put across the world press. And he had a major crackdown. They raided Kiryat Arba. They arrested all these people. They seized their cars. And a big trial grew out of that. It took place for over a year and a half with approximately 35 people, almost all of them, heads of families, fathers, and so on, could not go to work. Some of them were held in jail for several months. And out of that trial and the lawyers that were needed to help defend that trial, out of that major incident grew this one organization that became a legal defense organization. From that legal defense organization, as a result of the Intifada, without again getting into too much detailed history, that led to Oslo in 92, which was first called the first set of unilateral and disengagement, which was the Jericho-Aza first, and then led to the Oslo agreements. They had made a series of agreements. Oslo led to a whole new situation where the Arabs now finally for the first time believed that ultimately they were winning and they were going to succeed. And Arafat brought in an army into Yesha, and they allowed the equipping of 40,000 Arabs in Yesha itself to become part of what he called the police force. He was allowed to bring in, after all the efforts in the 1982 Lebanese War, when they forced Arafat out of Lebanon, and he took all his forces to Tunisia and all these other Arab countries. These Arabs were allowed to come back with their families and move back into Judea, Samaria, and Gaza. And in effect, a major Arab army now was right now placed in the heart of Israel. But more, not only was it in the heart of Israel, but it was right next door, literally across the street of many of the Yishuvim. And this created a whole new situation. So a number of other projects and groups were formed at the time. One was called Ovdei Haaretz, Workers of the Land. One was called Project Elon. We started planting trees. We started trying to quickly, what happened was, as of a result of Oslo, the government itself went ahead and de facto relinquished claim to all the land by freezing all future settlement construction, by fencing in all the existing settlements, by committing themselves not to build any new settlements. All the land that was won and liberated in the 1967 war, which was the majority of Yesha, almost 97% of the land of Judea, Samaria, and Gaza, that was declared government land, government of the State of Israel, was basically left unchallenged. And the Arabs took very, very quick advantage of that and began taking over all this land, all around the Yishuvim, all around the hills. We've started a number of other projects involving the reclamation of these lands by trying to retake these lands, specifically around the Yishuvim, specifically the ones that were strategic and overlooking the Yishuvim, so on and so forth. A lot of other things happened. The Tunnel War, those that remember 1996, where 1994 actually was the first time on Tisha B'Av in 94 when Arafat's forces challenged the Israeli army, which was called the Hamas riots, down in Gaza at the Erez crossing, and they burned several hundred buses that belonged to Egged that used to transport Arab workers. A lot of people don't even remember this. 96, they had the next major challenge against the Israeli army, which resulted in the death of 17 Israeli soldiers in the course of 48 hours, which is referred to as the Tunnel War, which they use the excuse of the fact that the first time in the Netanyahu government, he opened up the tunnels. Those that have had a chance to go on the tunnel tours next to the old city, when those tunnels were open, the Arabs used that as an excuse, claiming that the Jews were trying to seize Har HaBayit. As a result, they started out by attacking. The army had set up joint patrols together with PA forces as well as Israeli soldiers. In jeeps, they opened fire on those jeeps, and they killed the first two border policemen in the first hours of that mini-tunnel war, so on and so forth.
In other words, these were Jewish soldiers who had been going on joint patrols with the so-called Palestinian police or soldiers.
That's correct.
And all
in the
of
same,
a sudden,
in the same vehicle.
In the same That's vehicle. Right. So people would basically become quote-unquote buddies who were working together to protect lives. Suddenly, the Arab counterparts turned on the Jewish soldiers and murdered them.
Mm-hmm. Right there in the jeep. Yeah,
in the
at
jeep.
The time.
That
started it actually right there yeah, that morning.
And these,
that was the first. That was the first two soldiers to be murdered. And over the course of the next 48 hours, another 15 were killed in different situations. Some of it happened actually in Kevi Yosef. Does that remember the story? In Kevi Yosef, they trapped the soldiers in Kevi Yosef. There's a whole thing. They had to negotiate for the release. By the time they released those four soldiers, they were supposed to be transported by Jibril Rajub, who was the head of the security forces outside of Shechem, to Israeli forces. By the time they were delivered, those soldiers were dead. They were initially wounded, but by the time they were delivered, they were dead.
We're going to continue with this discussion in just a minute. I want to remind our listeners that they're tuned in to AM 620. This is the Jewish Activist Network. Our special guest tonight is Yisrael Danziger, who's speaking to us about Mishmeres Yesha. And I guess if I could summarize it, Yisrael, it's the reaction to all these incidents and many more, which you'll tell us about, that you're involved in protecting Jewish lives. It's basically the breakdown of security for Jewish communities in Yehuda and Shomron that you're responding to over the past decade and a half.
Yeah, well, security is one word, but it's more than just security. Mm-hmm. It was a complete change in the situation. It's basically a realization on the part of myself and other people that the way we were living, the way things were going, mm-hmm. if we weren't going to do anything about it, if we were going to allow things to continue the way they were occurring day by day, Different things were happening. Everything was being challenged. Every aspect of our lives was being challenged. The bottom line is we realized it would only be a matter of time before we wouldn't be living there very long.
Mm-hmm.
So we just could not go on with our daily lives the way we did before.
So we'll continue. We're going to continue with this right after this message. I want to remind our listeners that they can join our discussion, and we invite them to, by calling 718-569-0921. That's 718-569-0921 for the call and number on the here on AM 620 for the Jewish Activist Network, broadcasting Wednesday nights from midnight to 1 a.m. Are you looking for part-time work in advertising sales? The Jewish Activist Network has an opening for a sales representative. Email the Jewish Activist Network for details. The email address is media@jewishactivistnetwork.com. That's M-E-D-I-A, media@jewishactivistnetwork.com. And if you'd like to advertise with the Jewish Activist Network, email us at media@jewishactivistnetwork.com. Do you have Shemus at your house or at your shul? Allow us to handle your Shemus for you. We handle your Shemus in accordance with Halacha. Call 917-517-7486 for your Shemus handling. $20 for a 30-pound plastic kitchen bag, $8 for a plastic shopping bag. Larger quantities are eligible for our discount pricing. Call now for details. The number is 917-517-7486. Pesach is coming. Now is the time to schedule your Shemus handling. The number once again, 917-517-7486. Do you have email? Subscribe to Jewish Activist Network emails and Rabbi David Einenson's emails. The Jewish Activist Network emails are once a week and give you information about our upcoming shows, including links to background information. Rabbi Einenson's emails are brief, divrei Torah that are immediately relevant to our lives. Subscribe to Jewish Activist Network emails by sending an email to media@jewishactivistnetwork.com. Subscribe to Rabbi Einenson's emails by emailing media@secretscale.com. That's media, M-E-D-I-A, at secretscale, S-E-C-R-E-T-S-C-A-L-E.com. If you do shopping in Midwood, Borough Park, Sheepshead Bay, Bensonhurst, Bay Ridge, Mill Basin, Crown Heights, or the Five Towns, pick up a free copy of The Views, a weekly available in many stores. To advertise in The Views, 718-377-8016. You're tuned in to the Jewish Activist Network. I'm Joe Orlo, your host. We broadcast on here on AM 620 Wednesday nights from midnight to 1 a.m. Our special guest tonight is Yisrael Danziger of Mishmeres Yesha. We have a caller, and we'll take Mitchell now. Go ahead, Mitchell.
Yeah, how are you?
Fine, thank you.
Okay. Now, I'm listening. I tuned in. Just maybe I missed a minute, but it was like an oral history of security problems between like 1990 and maybe up to the present. I mean, I'm trying to be objective, but if one was listening to that, you know, let's say they just came in from Alaska, you know, they're not too hip on what's going on in the Middle East.
I'm not sure about that, but go ahead, Mitchell.
Yeah, but I mean, what is the bottom line supposed to be like? Look what the Palestinians did with the nail bombs, the Molotov cocktails, and the
Let's
kill them all. I mean, what is the bottom line? Let's get rid of the Palestinians.
It's a legitimate question. Yisrael, would you like to address that, please?
The only problem is I didn't understand what the question is. If you could phrase the question without making a statement.
What is the purpose of you reading the history?
What is the purpose of me reading the history?
I think his question was you gave a very succinct and to the point and very well put an articulated background of what the Arabs have been doing, the murderous attacks against Jews, and And so I think, Mitchell, in answer to your question, the purpose is to show that there was a great need. I don't want to, Yisrael, I don't want to speak for you, but I think if I could summarize it, there's a great need for Jews to stand up and say, our lives are important, and we have to address what's going on, what the Arabs are doing, and if we want to continue living where we're living. Yisrael, is that a fair assessment?
That's a fair enough assessment.
Yeah, we have it. All right. So maybe tell us in more detail. You mentioned a number of organizations that were formed. Can you pick out maybe one or two organizations and incidents that describe and then maybe can stand as examples of how you were able to change the situation in Yehuda and Shomron in response?
Well,
to
one of the main areas that I was sort of moving along chronologically, and I'm building up to really when we formed Mishmar Yeshua, which was 1998. As an umbrella organization, as part of a group called 24 Guards, Haftal Mishmarot, and this was an umbrella organization where we included all the different groups and organizations that we had set up, because we realized now at that point it was, since we had limited manpower, limited resources, that we were going to put them all under one umbrella, and we anticipated back in 98 already that the second Intifada was just around the corner. And
you're up to 98, and I feel bad. I don't want you to cut off the history.
I'm not. I'm just going to jump ahead quickly to 2003 Fada, which everybody, I'm sure, is aware of or should be aware of. September of 2000, Rosh Hashanah. The second Intifada broke out. This time already it was a whole different situation. Now we were facing an Arab army of 80,000 soldiers that were well-armed and equipped in Yehuda and Shomron. I'm going to jump to 2002. In 2002, they began adopted a new tactic and a new strategy, and they felt that it wasn't enough to continue attacking and using the methods they had used earlier, even though they continued attacking people on the roads. Only this time they were using firearms. They did something that was called drive-by shooting, something that happened, by the way, just a couple of months ago. Those that heard of Rav Chai from Shavei Shomron, who was murdered in a drive-by shooting. There have been many other drive-by shootings over the last couple of years, and there were many, many that took place during that time. But from besides using that main tactic of the attacks on the roads, again, drive-by shootings, snipings, and so on, what they developed was this new method of infiltrating into the communities of Yesha, and the idea was they were going to carry the war into the homes of the people living in Judea and Samaria and Gaza. And they did that by sending in these terrorist cells, sometimes one, two, or three, heavily armed, sometimes with explosive belts on them as well. And the idea was to enter into a yeshuv day or night, enter into the people's homes, and kill as many people as possible until either they were killed or they escaped. As a response to this situation, this is something that could not be dealt by any type of security forces because the time involved is so limited. The army had requested that the yeshuvim set up a system called a rapid response team. Rapid response team is basically a volunteer SWAT team. A SWAT team is a special weapons anti-terrorist team. That's what you have here in belonging to different police forces in the United States, especially since 9/11. They're equipped and trained to deal with a terror attack, a live terror attack in the event that they seize hostages or that they're attacking civilians. We have to set them up in this yeshuvim, in the yeshuvim. The problem was the Army did not institute any program whatsoever, either in equipping these are rapid response teams, or in training them. That's a program that we devoted a great deal of time, and we still do to this very day, in training these rapid response teams. We set up a program, 10, 12, and depending on what type of course, we had a number of different courses where these groups were taken. They were taken to training bases that the Army allowed us to use at the time. Later on, we used on private training facilities, and these teams were trained in anti-terror training. We equipped these teams as well with all the necessary state-of-the-art lightweight bulletproof armored vests, night vision equipment, silence communications equipment, day vision, night vision, and so on. And we managed to actually turn the tide together with the efforts on the part of all of the volunteers that joined these teams from the different rapid response teams. And fortunately, there's been almost no successful attacks, even though back then there was, in the course of almost 2 years, There were over 57 people killed inside the Yishuvim, several hundred wounded, and quite a few families that were totally destroyed. Nevertheless, in the years after that, from 2005, 2004, and 2005 on, they've barely been able to complete a successful terrorist attack inside of Yishuvim. Unfortunately, on the roads, and the situation on the roads is unfortunately something, a totally different situation that's totally under the control of the army. And that situation has improved greatly because the army has retaken, in Operation Defensive Shield, retaken the cities and control over the major areas and arteries of all of Judea and Samaria. Nevertheless, they succeed from time to time in carrying out road-by shootings. The Zolden family is one of them. Rav Chai is, Meir Chai is another one. And unfortunately, there are many others that have suffered over the last couple of years. That is one example of one of the projects that I was told that that we worked on. One of the more recent projects that we've devoted a great deal of time to is the project which I referred to back after Oslo, which is called Ovdei Haaretz, Workers of the Land. The idea was to encourage and, first of all, to remove all Arab labor from any of the Jewish communities, to try to convince Jews to hire only Jews, but that wasn't good enough just to talk about it. The idea was to create projects for Jews, training for Jews in a lot of the trades that, unfortunately, at this point today, have almost completely been taken over by either Arab or foreign labor. That's basically in the building trades, in the industrial trades, and as well as the farming trades. Over the years, we've been trying to develop different projects where we can take groups of students to do all sorts of agricultural projects, certain construction projects. And in the last year, we finally were able to take over a facility, an industrial building, in the Yishuv Nachliel, in Western Binyamin, where we completely renovated the building, and we've now set up this vocational training center where we have formal courses. We've begun formal courses in the building trades, where these students are going to be certified, students that come in from different places, and we have courses there that we've begun, and eventually we're going to have courses in all areas of in the building trades, whether involving wood, steel, or stone, and in the farming trades and agricultural trades as well. That's over time.
Yisrael, I want to come back to that. We have a number of callers and a commercial message. But we'll come back to that topic in just a minute of training Jews to be laborers in the trades. You're tuned in to AM 620. I'm Joe Orlo, your host. You're listening to the Jewish Activist Network, and our call-in number is 718-569-0921. We go on Wednesday nights from midnight to 1 a.m. We'll be on for another half hour or so. We have a number of callers we're going to take, but first this commercial message. Do you daven three times a day? If yes, then you are constantly reminding yourself of our national desire to rebuild the Beis HaMikdash, the temple in Jerusalem. Join us in reaching out to our brothers and sisters who are not yet aware of the importance of the Beis HaMikdash. Participate in International Temple Mount Awareness Day by visiting the Temple Mount in Jerusalem, making phone calls to the government in Eretz Yisrael, and other ways which are suggested on the website templeinstitute.org. Temple Mount Awareness Day is Rosh Chodesh Nissan, March 16th. For more information, visit templeinstitute.org. We have as our guest tonight Yisrael Danziger of Mishmeres Yesha. We have a caller now, Shifra. Shifra, you're on the air with us on the Jewish Activist
Network.
I'll
tell you, as you had a break in a commercial, I have to say this, not that I'm a teary person, I just started to cry. And my calling you is the lack of awareness of, you know, we live here in America, we may read in the paper, we don't know what's going on until you magnificently created the imagery of a picture of what's the reality of what's going on. And all right, we thank Joe for bringing this to our consciousness, but it's late at night or how many people are sleeping, and the Jews in America don't know.
Schiffer, what can we do,
and how can we raise this consciousness? You need an army in America also.
It's a start, Schiffer. Let me just say, there are thousands, tens of thousands of listeners here on the Jewish Activist Network. People are driving at night listening, people resting in their kitchen or perhaps lying in bed, yourself and others, many people up. I think it's a very fine time to start our campaign.
I know, but what can we do, Danziger? What can we do? How can we, not in the praying, how can we create an energy consciousness?
I think, Yisrael, you have some probably very practical ways that people can help here to implement what you're doing.
Well, what you can do, first of all, is definitely make people more aware of what's happening, because I'm always amazed by the fact that when I do to speak to people about what's going on there, how little they are aware of many of the things that I've just spoken about, even though this is something that's in the news. I mean, how many people are aware of the fact that during the early years of Intifada II, meaning the years of 2000, 2001, 2, 3, 4, and 5 in Israel, when the Intifada was raging, that basically 97% of the thousands of attacks that took place in Israel all took place in Judea, Samaria, and Gaza. Yes, most of the people heard about the big bus bombings, and unfortunately, most of the people that were killed throughout Israel, and the 1,600 people that were murdered in the course of that time, that took place in the cities of Israel. But the fact is that they only represent a very small number of the actual terror that's been was inflicted upon a relatively small population living in Yehuda and Shomron, on the 240,000-250,000 Jews that lived there at the time, who bore the brunt of most of this intifada, first intifada, second intifada, and who knows what's going to happen now with this, with the next stage, where very much so the Arabs are planning on basically de facto claiming a Palestinian state within the period of a year, with the support of the American government helping them to create this state. I mean, the Jews are just not. So there's a very big wake-up factor here. People just assume that, you know, they're going to be able to travel to Israel and take their kids for their bar mitzvahs, and everything's just going to be fine and dandy. That's not at all what's going on there, and that's not the way this is going to play out over a period of time. So the awareness and awakening, of course, is very important. The fact of the matter is, very, very few people, when they do come to visit Israel, even though there's such a tremendous increase, supposedly, in tourism to Israel, yet very, very few people come to Yesha. Very, very few people come to Yehuda and Shomron. Very, very few people. In all our literature over all the years, we've advertised to people to come and to email us when they make a trip to Israel, if they bring a group in, a bar mitzvah group, or they come for any event, to contact us, and we will take them on a tour for the day, and we will show them what's going on. We will explain everything I've just explained to you in the half hour on this radio, plus a lot more. But more importantly, we'll show you. We'll show you what's going on, and we'll show you what we're trying to do about it. And we'll tell you how you can help, and how you can help support us, because basically, there's a tremendous burden here that's been placed on the shoulders of very few people. And the bottom line is, my message is to everybody and to all the Jews in the world, is that it's time to share the burden.
Well, very, very well said. And we have to. I guess what we're doing is trying to get this, get the word out, so people should know. And having people like yourself on the show, which very, very knowledgeable people, and we really do appreciate it. Where do you see right now the situation going? And I understand that there's more situations that are happening. They might be related. Maybe you could tell us a little about the situations of Israeli youth and how that ties in. I understand that Hezbollah has been doing the flourishing business of importing drugs into Israel for many years. And I understand that you also have a program aimed at Israeli youth. How does that tie in? And tell us a little more about it.
The fact is, of course, Hezbollah completely controls Lebanon, and surely southern Lebanon, and nothing moves without their permission.
It's been an ongoing problem now for years. The smuggling of drugs across the Lebanese border. The main method used basically is communications between dealers on both sides of the border. Many of them are Israeli Arabs, but unfortunately, there's also Israeli Jews that have been involved in this. Different places and different locations. They basically simply place these drugs in small packages and throw them over the fence at different locations, and they're quickly picked up by smugglers and high-powered motorcycles on both sides of the border. They're brought to the border, they're taken into Israel on the other side, and this is how a great deal of the drugs moves into Israel over some period of time. Unfortunately, there's many other problems with the youth in Israel today. There's really been a breakdown in the school system, specifically the high school system, which has had, for the longest time, been moving in the direction of a valueless educational system. The dropout rates are very, very high.
You're speaking here of the, I guess, like a public school type educational system.
We're talking about the public school system, which is the main system in Israel, yes. Mm-hmm. Secular educational system in Israel. But it doesn't just apply to the secular. It also applies into many other areas, like in the Haredi system. There's a report that I believe you should have in front of you that was put out by...
You did send over the report.
Yes, it's called The Hidden Dropouts in Israel. It's actually an article written by Mati Wagner in the Jerusalem Post, and based on a study that was done by The Joint. So 5 million shekel was spent on it. And
whoa, 5 million. Okay.
That's what it says in the article.
Okay.
5 million shekel was spent on this study. It was done over a period of time. It's called The Hidden Dropouts. It refers to the Haredi community alone, just in that area alone. What they've been able to discover, and this is what they admitted to, they claim the numbers are even higher, 34,000 dropouts that are not in any educational system. They're not in any yeshiva. They're just on the street. Some of them are not around the street. Some of them, all of them are not in school. Many of them are not even at home anymore, which has become another problem, which is wayward youth living all over the place, different parts of the country, homeless type youth that are just don't go back home anymore, and so on. And these are all students. These are boys that don't end up going to the army because they've not geared to do that at all. Because of the lifestyle, they don't have really any basic education. They don't have the most basic form of education, meaning reading or writing or arithmetic or anything of the sort, they're just hanging out in the streets.
But now you're addressing this. You're training young people. You're giving them jobs that the work is out there, because if Arabs are doing the work, there's work out there, and you're training them in this program that you have. Can you give us some practical ideas if somebody wanted to support that? If, you know, someone listening really is interested and wants to join in what you're doing, and I'm sure many of our listeners do want to do that. How can they help you with your school and the training that you're doing?
We're trying to increase these programs. We're trying to increase the training programs, facilities, and projects. Every program that we do has an actual project that they work on, and these projects are literally building projects in different places. We're trying to spread these courses out as quickly as we can, but obviously we're limited in the resources, because all this takes a lot of money. It takes a lot of logistics, a lot of movement of materials, a lot of movement of equipment, a lot of movement of instructors, and so on and so forth. And to make this happen, it obviously requires money. Without money, it's impossible to get anything done.
Nothing happens without money in this world. Tell me, how can somebody on give you a donation and speak to you if they want to be part of this?
Well, the best way to speak to us is to contact us through our by email. Which is our email is guards, G, the word guards, just like in somebody guarding a building, guard, G-U-A-R-D-S, plural guards, and the number 24, guards 24, at Zahav, Z-A-H-A-V, .net, .il, I-L for Israel, .il.
So
anybody who wants to write us and is interested in really helping, there are many different ways, and how they can support us financially as well. We'll be more than happy to respond to each and every person that is interested.
So it's guards 24, the number 24, guards 24, at Zahav, Z-A-H-A-V, dot net, N-E-T, dot I-L.
Correct.
So this to me is the core mission of the Jewish people, or one of the core missions of living in Eretz Israel. You're taking young Jewish people, training them in trades, like you said, with wood, with stone, with metal, how to build buildings, which is a key part of any operation, and training them also in how to farm the land in agriculture. That's what it's all about. Isn't that what the ingathering of the exile is all about, to develop the land in just the way that you're doing?
Well, unfortunately, fortunately, at least in the 100 years preceding the State of Israel, the Aliyah, the first Aliyah, the second Aliyah, the great focus, even though many of those people did not have a necessarily religious upbringing and were not ideologically religious, nevertheless, they understood that in order for them to come and come to Israel and build it up as a country, they themselves would have to have hands-on participation in building that state, not having anybody farm workers or so on. They knew that the new Jew, from where they came from the ghettos of Europe, from the drudges of the cities and the dregs of all forms of society that they had lived in, if they were to come to a new country and build a new society, in order to have a sovereign Jewish state, they would have to actually build the state on their own, build their own roads, build their own farms, farm their own land, build their own factories, operate their own factories, build their own buildings and institutions. And building means physically building everything, and that is what happened, and that's the way things were in Israel for many years up until the state. Unfortunately, things started deteriorating specifically after 1967 with the influx of cheap Arab labor. Later on, the involvement of greedy businessmen that set up these manpower companies and were given the permits to bring in foreign workers, and brought in these hundreds of thousands of foreign workers. Slowly but surely, the situation deteriorated.
In other words, some businesses, it was a number of, if it's that large, brought in hundreds of thousands, right, in a population. What would you say the Jewish population is, Blayan Hara, of Eretz Israel, on the order of about 5 million?
About 5 to 5.5 million, depending how you're counting, right?
And then and then on top of that, they brought in foreign workers to the tune of hundreds of thousands of people.
That's correct.
And these foreign workers, I mean, we have no, I'm sure they're very fine people and they want to, you know, make a day's wage, but that's not what the concept, I think, of what a state of Israel should be about. I think that's
no. Many of these foreign workers, a lot of problems have developed as a result of it. Some of them, a lot of them, have come there, married Israeli women. I don't know if you're familiar with the problem now. There's a big ongoing campaign in Israel because Israel wants their permits that are up from a number of these foreign workers. Some of them have married each other, created families, and have given birth to children in Israel. Now they want to live in Israel, and they want to receive the rights and citizenship. And there's a big campaign on the part of many of the liberal leftist organizations to allow them to stay and give these people automatic citizenship because they were born in Israel. Since the children were born in Israel, they would be given citizenship. And since the parents, they can't leave the children, they would out the parents. So the parents, de facto, would become citizens, even though they're basically illegals at that point.
Yisrael, we're going to come back to this in just a minute after a commercial message. For our listeners, you're tuned in to AM 620. I'm Joe Orlo, your host. The call number is 718-569-0921. We have a commercial break, and then we're going to take a caller. Our special guest tonight is Yisrael Danziger of Mishmeres Yesha, who's outlining for us the situation in Eretz Yisrael and also some very practical steps that he's taking and that we can be helpful to him with in how we can make the State of Israel a better place for Jews to live. We'll be right back. Are you looking for part-time work in advertising sales? The Jewish Activist Network has an opening for a sales representative. Email the Jewish Activist Network for details. The email address is media@jewishactivistnetwork.com. That's M-E-D-I-A, media@jewishactivistnetwork.com. And if you'd like to advertise with the Jewish Activist Network, email us at media@jewishactivistnetwork.com. Do you have Shemus at your house or at your shul? Allow us to handle your shamus for you. We handle your shamus in accordance with halacha. Call 917-517-7486 for your shamus handling. $20 for a 30-pound plastic kitchen bag, $8 for a plastic shopping bag. Larger quantities are eligible for our discount pricing. Call now for details. The number is 917-517-7486. Pesach is coming. Now is the time to schedule your shamus handling. The number once again, 917-517-7486. Do you have email? Subscribe to Jewish Activist Network emails and Rabbi David Einenson's emails. The Jewish Activist Network emails are once a week and give you information about our upcoming shows, including links to background information. Rabbi Einenson's emails are a brief Divrei Torah that are immediately relevant to our lives. Subscribe to Jewish Activist Network emails by sending an email to media@jewishactivistnetwork.com. Subscribe to Rabbi Einenson's emails by emailing media@secretscale.com. That's media, M-E-D-I-A, at secretscale, S-E-C-R-E-T-S-C-A-L-E.com. If you do shopping in Midwood, Borough Park, Sheepshead Bay, Bensonhurst, Bay Ridge, Mill Basin, Crown Heights, or the Five Towns, pick up a free copy of The Views, a weekly available in many stores. To advertise in The Views, 718-377-8016. Do you daven three times a day? If yes, then you are constantly reminding yourself of our national desire to rebuild the Beis HaMikdash, the temple in Jerusalem. Join us in reaching out to our brothers and sisters who are not yet aware of the importance of the Beis HaMikdash. Participate in International Temple Mount Awareness Day by visiting the Temple Mount in Jerusalem, making phone calls to the government in Eretz Yisrael, and other ways which are suggested on the website templeinstitute.org. Temple Mount Awareness Day is Rosh Chodesh Nissan, March 16th. For more information, visit templeinstitute.org. You're tuned in to AM 620 WSNR. I'm Joe Orla, your host here on the Jewish Activist Network, broadcasting Wednesday nights from midnight to 1 a.m. Our special guest tonight is Yisrael Danziger of Mishmeres Yesha. Yisrael, you were just mentioning another difficulty and challenge facing the Jews living in Israel, that foreign workers are coming in, and it can in some ways be disruptive not only to the economy but also to the very fabric of the society. So I think, again, if I could summarize, the work that you're doing in training Jewish youth to be working in the trades serves three functions. One, it gives Jewish young people an education, gives them an opportunity to make a living. It pushes, I don't know what term to use, it Arabs who have moved into the trades who are hostile to the nation, to the Jewish people, on the one hand have become in some ways, if I could use the term, almost essential because they're monopolizing some of the trades, and at the same time they're hostile. So by having Jews taking over some of this work, it improves life for the Jews in the land of Israel. And on top of that, it precludes any kind of necessity or any kind of need for workers to come from other countries to perform some tasks. So can you tell us a little bit more on a practical basis of how you form the schools and how it might work? Give an example of how some of the program might work on a day-to-day basis.
Well, what we're trying to do is, one of the areas that we're working on right now is we have three courses going on at the moment of, and specifically they're learning a 4-month course in the trades of, what we call, the building of, foundations, building of what's called a shelid, a skeleton frame of a building. Most of the, private homes or small apartment buildings are built of, up to 4 stories. This course was once, a course you given by, the Ministry of Labor, which doesn't exist today anymore. There is no Ministry of Labor. There's something called Ministry of Tamat, Tasiya Mishchar V'Tasuka. It's combined together with the industrial aspect of the government. Nevertheless, there used to be a course that we took the actual material that was used in the previous course, including the actual printed material that we've reprinted, we photocopied, and we've now recreated this course, and the idea is that we've set them up in groups of 4, what we call a tzevet, a team with a team leader, and they're trained to work as a team, a team leader with 3 other men, 4-man teams, and from blueprint reading, from everything involved, taking a set of prints, going out to a site, going out to an area of open land, finding the exact location of the site of the building, laying out the points of the border of that particular lot, laying out the heights, the differences, bringing in a tractor, marking it off for him, allowing him to literally cut open the earth so that you can have the foundation set up, laying out the site layout, which is in itself a something that's fairly difficult to do. And from that point on, building the actual formwork, the wood formwork for the concrete, mm-hmm. the steel work, what's called the rebar, reinforcement bar, they're taught to tie it, to bend and tie this reinforcement bar and place it inside, and actually do the foundations, do the platform of the first floor, do the columns going up to the second floor, ceilings, third floor, and so on. All the practical aspects of building a home. Right now we're trying to create in a number of different places, specifically in the areas of Kiryat Arba and the HaChevron area, Gush Tzion, in the Binyamin area, and hopefully in the Shomron, a number of these teams, so that already they will be available to take on projects in the Yishuvim in the area, and they will not require the use of Arab labor, which is basically the main, with the exception of a few Yishuvim, the main form of labor that takes place in all the communities in Yesha today.
Now, let me just mention, we didn't even touch upon another topic which really dovetails with this. That is the PA legislation forbidding Arabs from working in settlements. So not only do you have the outside workers coming, which is a problem, and the Jewish youth that are dropouts and need help, but there's actually a real threat that there will not be, possibly the way that it might enforce it, might be by force, not to allow Arabs to come into work, which could possibly paralyze all construction. Maybe you could tell us a little bit about that.
Well, this reminds me really of something that Arafat himself was very much involved in a number of years ago. There were certain Jewish communities in Yesha that decided that they were going to maintain good relationships, quote-unquote, with their Arab neighbors, and they became, they sent representatives to the nearby Arab villages to help promote projects for the Arabs in that village. They actually raised money overseas and brought money in to help them build schools, give scholarships to the Arab students that graduated from these schools to go to university, and so on and so forth. And there came a time when Arafat did not want any involvement on the part of the Jews in any which way, meaning he wanted to maintain complete control. And by doing so, he threatened the Mukhtarim, the heads of these villages, that if they take any money from the Jews, they would be punished severely. And eventually they broke off. Recently, there's been a proposal of legislation on the part of the PA, what's referred to as the Palestinian Administration, where they want to outlaw the Arabs living in Judea and Samaria, and also not to work in any of the yeshuvim, not to do any work for Jews. And this is part of an ongoing Arab boycott that they've already been working on now in the last months. They had a public burning of Israeli products. Because believe it or not, there are products that are produced in places where there are industrial parks, like in Mishor Adumim, like in Barkan, different Israeli food products. And these food products are sold throughout Israel, and they're also sold to the Arabs, and they end up in Arab grocery stores and in Arab supermarkets throughout Judea and Samaria, maybe even as far as Gaza. These products now, they've now are just about completed enforcing this boycott where they don't want to allow any more purchases of any of these products, and they consider them off-limits. By the way, they recently have been successful in enforcing in Europe, the European Union, which these Israeli products, as among many other Israeli products, that apparently they had certain tariffs that they were not required to pay because of an agreement that Israel had with the European Union. And they were exporting products to Europe to be sold. They've now put a ban on all products coming from Judea and Samaria. The ban basically says that since Judea and Samaria, quote-unquote, is not Israel, Therefore, any products coming from them are not subject to the same laws, and therefore major taxes will be put on them, making them, of course, making them not worthwhile to even bother purchasing them. As I said, they had this big, they took about 150,000 shekel worth of products that were gathered up from all these different Arab stores, and they had this public burning in Ramallah of these Israeli products. And the next stage now they're following through is they're trying to force the situation where they're boycotting all the Jewish settlements but not allowing Arab labor. Now we allow the Arabs of Judea and Samaria to go and work and help build the settlements.
But doesn't that dovetail with what you're doing?
Well, it doesn't. Yeah, I mean, and in the end, ultimately, it will create a situation. I mean, I am all for what they're doing. I'm not quite sure they're going to be able to enforce it because many of those people are very reliant upon the fact that they've been working for Jews all these years, and they very much need that work to survive. Nevertheless, we will see what level of enforcement they're going to use. They have the means and they're able to do it if they want to. If they do that, and that will be a step in the right direction, in my opinion, because that will remove a lot of this Arab labor from the Yishuvim. But for if they do really put that into effect and they enforce it, many places like Beitar Elite, Kiryat Sefer, and so on, where a very large amount of Arab labor comes into those places every day, and basically that's the main labor force that's building those places, are not going to be available for some time to come until they're replaced by Jewish labor, and that's going to take you some time and a great deal of effort to do that.
We're speaking with Yisrael Danziger here on the Jewish Activist Network. Yisrael, you're doing great work there. You know, it just occurs to me as you're speaking that there are young people here in the United States. We've had we've talked about this on the air with the term the term we use is so-called yeshiva dropouts, and I think what you're doing is so important because it can help young Jewish people around the world who are looking for something. School hasn't worked for them, and maybe college is not an alternative. You have the program to help these people. We just have a few minutes left. Maybe give us an encouraging picture of what the what will unfold in the future, the good things that are coming up. We just have about 2 or 3 minutes. Give us something positive, and again, let our listeners know how they can help you.
The encouraging thing is that there's no question about it that in Israel itself, people have woken up, unfortunately, at a terrible cost, like many other cases. But it's been shown that those that are following the news in Israel and understand, and the last election results are roughly a year ago, understand that today the leftist parties are basically made up of fewer and fewer people. And the ideas that were presented and were part of their ideology over the years has to a great deal dissipated. Many people, unfortunately, have woken up. As I said, when I say as a cost, this is after Gush Katif. This is after people believe that situation that some sort of disengagement or the actual giving up of land would actually lead to something positive. Today, there are very, very few people in Israel that really believe that anymore. They've come to the understanding that there really is no one to deal with on the other side of the fence, and any sort of walking away from any part of the land of Israel ultimately will just lead to a worsening of the security situation, such as what's happened in Gaza, such as the rocketing of the whole Western Negev, and so on and so forth. The problem is that, again, to make changes happen on the ground, they're not going to happen by themselves. It requires a great deal of effort, a great deal of self-sacrifice, a great deal of manpower, a great deal of energy, and something that cannot happen overnight. It's not enough to talk about it. It's not enough to write about it. It's not enough to email about it. It's not enough to even demonstrate about it. It has to be done physically. Things have to change hands-on. And the way to do it and the right way to make those changes is to seek out and to support the people, the few groups of people that are actually trying to make these changes happen.
Such as yourself. We're just about out of time. We're speaking with Yisrael Danziger. We encourage everybody to support you, Yisrael, and they can email you at the email address you gave out before, guards24@zahav.net.il. Thank you very much for being with us here on the Jewish Activist Network, and we look forward to having you with us again very soon.
Thank you for having me.
Do you daven three times a day? If yes, then you are constantly reminding yourself of our national desire to rebuild the Beis HaMikdash, the Temple in Jerusalem. Join us in reaching out to our brothers and sisters who are not yet aware of the importance of the Beis HaMikdash. Participate in International Temple Mount Awareness Day.